Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. Lauren Chatter is the author of two novels, The Lace Weaver and Gulliver's Wife, published by Simon & Schuster. She has also published a small baking compendium, Well-Read Cookies, inspired by her love of baking and reading.
Dr. Sarah Jane Burton is a Plath Scholar and a researcher of poetry and literary history at ANU. She has a master's degree and a PhD in English and has received fellowships from multiple universities for her research, including Harvard. She is currently the official historian for the New England Poetry Club in Boston. I love this.
I know.
Baby writers.
Everything about it.
Everything about it. Plath. I did go and get my Plath books out of the bookshelf and bring them in with me because I was like feeling very Plath-ish, if there's such a thing.
Did you read her work as a teen, or how old were you?
I think
you
probably in that. Do you reckon there was a time, like kind of year 11, when Plath was passed around between the girls?
Not high school,
not
I don't reckon.
I reckon there was another girl in lit class who like passed me a copy of Plath.
It has stood the test of time. I think I only read it, or I read The Bell Jar, and I haven't read any of her poetry. Like 2 years ago or something, and it was blown away. And I read Catcher in the Rye around the same time and was like,
I remember you having the classic moment.
Both of those books I just was really, really taken with.
I did think that this would make a great movie, like these two gifted baby writers together from the two different, like one from the country and one from the city, and the cassette tapes of Plath, and then that they reconnected.
Yeah,
on Goodreads.
The only good thing Goodreads has ever done.
See, maybe we're looking at it the wrong way, Catherine. Looking at Goodreads the wrong way. Maybe you actually need it as a space to like see if there's old school friends you want to connect with.
It's like on Facebook there. For literary people.
Yeah. I was blown away by the frankness and the intimacy and the willingness of these two friends to share their stories. I thought that was so delightful. And I did, in a moment of synchronicity, because my mum and dad are cleaning out a lot of storage during their time in ISO, they have delivered to the driveway, it's socially distanced, about four boxes of my stuff, right? Like that I kept.
Your old writing?
Old writing, sort of stuff? Yeah. And I am a hoarder. Like the notes that were passed between me and my friends, a couple of love letters in there, like it's difficult to read.
It's so
funny to look at and terrible. And but I did find a poem last week that I wrote to my girlfriends in serialized form, like a verse novel.
And about it's
a love, you know, thwarted love, as I tend to write about all the time, Catherine. Yeah. But I would really like to see. What I feel like we should have asked Lauren and Sarah Jane to release some of their baby writing.
We should have.
Maybe we can hit them up on Twitter.
I like the baby writing. It probably says a lot about a person. I just remember we did, my group of friends or my two besties did little comics was what we passed back and forth.
Do you still have them?
I would still have some of them at mum and dad's, and I think they would probably last the test of time. They were very funny. Just, you know, stupid things about us sort of going to parties and, you know, trying to talk to boys and all that sort of stuff and invariably failing. But they were very, very funny.
I love it. We can do this when we all get out of ISO. We can do this as part of our next live event. Everyone bring your baby writing.
Cathartic.
Such a lovely conversation. Enjoy. And thank you, everyone, for the feedback. And the sharing of these conversations on Twitter and on Instagram, it's been completely delightful. So keep it coming.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Hi, Lauren. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. Thank you for joining me and agreeing to have a chat and being part of our conversations with friends as part of the first time podcast new series. So I'm really grateful to them for letting us take over the airwaves for a while.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
It's awesome. I've been listening to them for, well, since the first season, and they just keep getting better and better. Mm. So I thought we could just introduce ourselves quickly. I'm Lauren Chater. I'm the author of The Lace Weaver, which came out in 2018. Sure. And I've just released my second novel, Gulliver's Wife, through Simon & Schuster. And over to you.
I am Sarah Jane Burton. I am a research fellow in literary studies at the Australian National University in the School of Literature, Languages and Linguistics.
So I thought we could just start by talking a little bit about how we met, because it's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
Go back into the recesses of our mind to remember that.
Yeah, cast our minds back. So we met when we were about 14. I think we were 14.
Yeah, yeah. I always try to remember exactly. I think, yeah, we weren't quite mid-teens, just before.
Yeah.
But yeah.
We were in that year
eight, year nine, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, eight or nine. And we were really geeky. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, but that
hasn't changed. You were. I wasn't. No, we both were, definitely.
I have news for you.
yep.
Yeah, we were both quite geeky and gawky, and we were invited by our school. Our schools put us forward for a program for gifted writers that was being run through the University of New South Wales.
Yeah, yeah.
It was called Jerrig, if you remember, and we were all invited to come and stay near the campus and take part in, I think it was like a week-long research project, and we were kind of guinea pigs, but I don't remember.
We were, I don't know. It's interesting for me looking back on it now as a researcher to think, oh, yeah, I was actually the subject of someone else's
you
research.
Were?
but, yeah, it was I had done, I'm not sure whether you had, Lauren, or not, but I had done a short course with Jerrick just before. I think it was like 12 months before, a writing course. And I was from quite a long way away from Sydney, like 5 or 6 hours away from Sydney in the country. And because I'd done that course, I think they reached out to me to be part of it as well. So I think they wanted a good assortment, so they needed to get their country kids in there as well. So
yeah, right. That's interesting. Yeah, no, I just remember my school. I went to Newtown High School, so in the city, and they put me forward for it. So
yeah, you went to the fancy creative school.
I went to the but like English wasn't.
I didn't.
English is not performing arts, but it's they had a really good they had a good English department there, and they were always like really encouraging to me and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, and so we went there and we did that for a week, and I think we just got along really well, didn't we? And
yeah we just
really,
did
it. I was mean, really intense.
We had, there were a lot of really serious people there, which is,
you know,
when you've got a 12-year-old that's, you know, very intense sitting next to you, it's kind of funny. Yeah. And I think we thought it was kind of funny. So we sort of connected on that level.
Yeah.
But, the idea was that we were doing writing exercises about being gifted writers or being children, I guess, or young
that's
teens.
Right.
And then they were taking that material and I guess, analysing it and... Yeah. I never heard what happened to it. I tried to
I think
sort
they were
going to
write
down,
a book.
Yeah.
They were going to write a book, but it never happened. And
no,
I was
didn't.
Like so disappointed. And then only later did I realise that so many books never actually get
no.
never actually make it.
Yeah. And so much research never comes to see the light of day. So
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I was looking forward to seeing my name in a book that took another 30 years to happen.
Yeah. You got there in the end.
Yeah. Yes.
We were little writers, I guess, baby writers. I like to tell people we were baby writers together. That's how we met.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we would spend we would travel to see each other in the holidays.
Yeah.
And I would come to Forbes where you lived in the country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep, kind of a barren cultural waste.
Dry.
A little bit.
No.
Just dry, this is, dusty.
This is pre-internet too. This is...
I know, exactly. And I remember when they had the McDonald's was installed and they were everyone was really excited because the kids finally had somewhere to go.
Yeah, they're getting a KFC soon apparently, so the town is still booming.
There's two main streets though, right?
Yeah, two.
There's two main...
Yeah. You've got to have two main streets if you're going to hang laps around the main streets.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, I think one of my favorite memories of that kind of difference in the city versus the country for us in terms of riding, actually, we'll connect to what we're going to talk about a little bit later. Has to do with Sylvia Plath. Lauren, because Lauren had access to Newtown and all of the shops that were there, the bookstores and everything. When I would go and visit her, a wonderful father would take us to go to all the bookstores and we'd spend hours wandering around, and I thought it was the best thing ever. We did not have a bookstore in Forbes. But I remember you tracked down a cassette recording for me of Sylvia Plath, and it was it was the first time I had ever heard her voice, and I remember it arriving in the post. I don't know if I told you this. It arrived in the post. Must have ordered it from a bookstore, and then you sent it to me, and I put it in my stereo, and it was just the most exciting thing. And I was so amazingly disappointed when I heard her voice, because it was not at all what I had expected. I was like, "What? This is not my Sylvia. This is not what is going on here." But it was just interesting that was I had been a Sylvia Plath devotee for years, and that access to hearing her voice was just such a huge deal. I mean, now we can just go on the internet and hear recordings and and see interviews and all that with our favorite writers, but back then it was different. We didn't have the same kind of access we have now, so Lauren was my lifeline.
And you were kind of my lifeline, because the cows just getting away from the city sometimes. And seeing what life was really like out of the urban sort of privileged areas as well.
Yeah.
We take a lot of that for granted.
Definitely.
In the city. Mm-hmm. So, and it was always really nice to have you around and, go and visit museums and just have someone who I really got along with well and was on
we
the same wavelength.
We had a lot of fun together.
We did.
Still do.
And so then we still do. So we lost touch for a little while in our 20s because we were off doing stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we reconnected a couple of years ago through Goodreads, which it was Goodreads.
Yeah,
and we both were commenting on a book. Uh-huh. And then I was like, I know that name. And then we started chatting and
But you had a different last name.
Out.
I knew your face, but you had a different last name because you got
married
in the interim.
Funny. But and it's just been so nice to we still have a lot in common, and probably even more so now because of research and the writing. And so it's been good.
It's funny how you grow up and you think you're going to be so different than the person that you were, but realistically we are still those same geeky teenagers room.
I find it kind of comforting in a way.
It's good because we get paid to be those geeky teenagers now.
Exactly.
In adult land.
Exactly.
Which is awesome.
There's some kind of validation there a little bit.
There is.
Whereas we were just kind of really, we had a lot of self-esteem issues and things like that. Especially in intense teenagers.
Yes. Broody, angsty.
Introverts.
Writing.
Have those issues. I thought we could talk about Sylvia Plath, because she's obviously your lifelong obsession.
She is, she started it all for me.
Yeah, she did. And I must confess that I had never read Sylvia Plath until this weekend, just gone. And I thought, because we were going to do this podcast, I thought I had better read her work.
Yep.
And so I did. I read The Bell Jar and a couple of her poems. And oh my God, I get it.
You get it now?
I can't believe I get it.
It's good. I was going to sever our friendship if you didn't sort that out soon. I mean, come on.
I know. I don't know how I avoided it for so long, but she's incredible. And
For a writing woman, I think, or, a writer in general, I shouldn't be, gender specific there, but She's so interesting from the perspective of people who have creative minds and, you know, engage in creative practice. And she sort of ponders, you know, those questions, and she also ponders questions of womanhood, you know, and a lot motherhood. Of sort of motherhood, a lot of things that are so universal. And I think in our brief conversations before this podcast, we were talking about that universality and how she hasn't seemed to date, you know, even though she's mid 20th century, still feels like, you know, it's very relevant now. So
definitely. Reading it, I just thought this could be, you know, this could have been written by a young woman now who is trying to understand her place in the world and what she's going through, sort of her mental health as well, issues. And
Definitely.
It's so dark. The Bell Jar is so, I did not know what to expect. I didn't read anything about it, really,
because I didn't want to
sort of influence how I was going to approach it. And then, about three quarters of the way through, I was like, oh, wow, this is heavy.
Yeah. Just a bit of background for people who may not have heard of Sylvia Plath. She is most well known for being a poet, but she did write one novel. So when we talk about, you know, debut novels or novel writing, she had the one novel, which is The Bell Jar. And it's the story of Esther, who is a young woman who's a creative. She's a poet and a writer herself. And she gets the opportunity of a lifetime, doesn't she, to go and do an internship at Mademoiselle magazine in New York City. And during that period, she slowly sort of mentally unravels. And it's interesting. I actually came up to Sydney and stayed with you, Lauren, when I did my own internship at Dolly. Do you remember that?
I know. Reading it, I was like, this is your life.
In a way. It's creepy, hey.
It's a bit creepy.
I have a background in media before I was in academia, and there's a lot of kind of connections with her that they were very close to home. Yeah. So and even that, you know, a lot of the things she talks about her experience, it was similar, you know. So
I understood a lot more about you when I read it.
I didn't end up in a mental asylum after that internship.
We've all struggled. We both struggle with sort of mental health issues and anxiety and
definitely
that kind of thing. And and also that that idea of making art, creating art against all the obstacles that are in your way.
And I think the creative mind, the thinking mind, has a tendency to race, and you know, that she really does sort of articulate that in words, that racing mind, and how it sort of goes in spirals, and it can be your worst enemy sometimes. And I think a lot of writers deal with that. A lot of academics deal with that, from people that I have known my whole career. So it's definitely something that we should be open about. I think that the gifts that often give us what we do can also destroy us or temporarily impinge our outputs, even if it's just procrastinating.
And you look at right now with the pandemic, you know, you think, how is that affecting the way that people are producing creative work? And I've had to stop for a little while because I just don't know how to articulate exactly what's going on and how do I write. If you're writing about a book, like, do you set it in the before time or do you set it in the after?
I know that's because something that you're dealing with at the moment with your current work. How to
there's going to be those two
For sure. Yeah,
those two distinct time periods.
For sure. Well, I my research is primarily based in the US, and I do a lot of work with archival material, which has required me to travel pretty regularly back and forth to the US and also spend significant amounts of time there. And I had been planning on going back later this year and then spending a good portion of next year in the US. But now, I am not sure, you know, what the future holds. So everything changes, you know, our plans, our work, and we have to adapt. And I think there's a lot of pressure on people at the moment to have like increased productivity because we're all at home and supposedly that is contingent to, oh, we're all going to write the, you know, the great novel and Shakespeare wrote King Lear when he was, you know, isolated and I don't know, since Isaac Newton invented something and all these memes.
Were they looking after their kids though?
Yeah.
Were they homeschooling? No.
Yeah. Were they online shopping? No.
Yeah, probably not.
Didn't
have the temptations of the internet.
But I think that like we were just talking about before, that increases that pressure and that that racing mind starts to think, well, what's wrong with me? Why can't I actually produce even more right now than I can do on a regular day? And it's detrimental in that way as well, because I think we have to be kind to ourselves because it is an unusual situation we're in.
I found it really breathless, almost, the pace of the bell jar. It just it hurtles along from thing to thing. And then after a while, I mean, I thought this is actually her. She's almost the ultimate unreliable narrator because on the one hand, she's narrating breathlessly what's happening, but then she's not, you know, she's not taking in the impact of what she's doing, her actions. And it's, well, she's disassociating, obviously. You know, especially when you get to the later sections and sort of the suicidal ideation, things like that.
Yeah. But I mean, that really intensely personal narration, I think, is unreliable, because if we think of our own minds, they are unreliable. Yeah. You know, they're not, totally. It's not always rational. It's not always informed by, you know, there's not some omniscient voice that's telling you, oh, this is how you do this. This is how you do that. This is how you think about this. Right. So I think she's exploring that, really well.
Yeah.
That you do learn, you pick up things if you're interested in kind of, you know, Googling or Wikipediaing things as you read through that novel. I can tell you that you will learn a lot. Her poetry is the same. They're like just loaded and loaded with both contemporary references and mythological references and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot there.
And so tell me, how did you shape a career around Sylvia Plath interest in her?
It definitely was not a plan. It wasn't like I woke up one day, you know, when I was a teenager and said, I'm going to make a career out of the fact I like Sylvia Plath. I never thought that was that would happen to me. I came across her very randomly. My mother used to take me to the library pretty regularly in my hometown. It was still one of my favourite places. And just let me wander. And I just I pulled books off the shelves. I didn't destroy the library. And I read a lot of, stories and novels. And then I just found poetry and I found her. Just I can't even remember whether it was Ariel or I'm pretty sure it was just her collected poems. And then it kind of expanded from there. And I read a lot of other poetry as well. And I just love poetry and I wrote poetry. I wrote a lot of poetry. And I ended up going to uni to study creative writing and actually was focused on poetry and then decided I wanted a real job, which was going to be working in magazines. So I went back to that, which was also the kind of secondary interest that I had. Went and did that for 3 years, and every night I would go to the North Sydney Library after work and read poetry. So I sort of thought, what am I doing here? You know, I should really go and do what I actually love, which turned into a master's in English literature. And during that period, again, I really honed in on poetry. And my plan was always just to go back to work after that 12-month master's. And I wrote a dissertation for my master's that turned into a PhD, and then the PhD turned into a research career, which turned into a job in the English department at Macquarie. And it just kind of grew. Yeah, that one thing kind of just grew from the next. And I can still remember thinking about doing a PhD and thinking, no way, there's no way I would spend that amount of time focused on one topic. I just couldn't do it. I always thought I wasn't smart enough for that. A lot of academics have the imposter syndrome where we think, you know, any day now someone's going to figure out that we're not actually that smart.
A lot of writers have it too.
I ended up writing my PhD dissertation on, it wasn't just on Sylvia Plath, it was on Sylvia Plath, Robert Lowell and Anne Sexton. And it was actually about creative practice and writers' influences on each other and connectivity. Cool. So it's called The Boston Trio. It's not a book yet, but it will be soon, hopefully. So look out for that title. But it's yeah, it just explored how the three of them knew each other, and they actually worked in a creative writing seminar at Boston University for only 3 months. They were crossed over in that period, and shortly after, all three of them had their poetic breakthroughs basically in their careers.
Yeah, right.
So I look at how, you know, those breakthroughs were contingent both on the city where they lived, which was Boston, and their connection to each other. So yeah, since then I'm not working on Plath now. My project is on poetry, and it is on American poetry, but yeah, it's not Plath anymore. So
Plath will always be there.
Yes, of course. I mean, I just went and grabbed, I was like, which copy of the Bell Jar do I want? Because I collect copies of the Bell Jar, so many editions.
And so how does publication differ for you from the commercial side? For me, is it's quite fast-paced in a sense. Like, you know, we're expected to sort of be writing sort of most constantly, and then sort of delivering manuscripts, of course, never really works out that way because things take a lot of time. But that's kind of the ideal. So is in academia, are you expected to publish pretty regularly as well?
Definitely. Yeah. It's any academic will tell you that it's a really hard job. People think it's the greatest kind of job in the world because you just get to spend your time, you know, researching and exploring the things that you love, but there is a lot of pressure, especially on early career researchers, which is the position that I am, which is still 5 years out from the completion of your PhD. The job market's saturated, so you really need to be doing a million things at once. So in the academic line of work, it is journal publications, you should have multiple journal publications on the go at once, which is hard.
Yeah.
Plus we're expected to be working on long form research projects, which are books. We are also teaching, and we are also, creating all that content. And then, you know, just dealing with students is a full-time job.
Yeah.
But then there's also, you know, the administrative stuff. There's writing and presenting conference papers. So they're all, I guess, they're the kind of main parts of the role. And roles differ. I mean, I'm really, really lucky now because I'm in a research-focused role. My previous role when I was an academic in the English department at Macquarie, it was pretty constant, and you're really trying to carve out that time to write and research and think. You know, you actually need time to think, and I think that's something that people don't realize, that you can't just be pouring out words and original ideas, and you know, your cognitive functioning needs that time to sort of simmer.
I think there's a lot of similarities then between
there are definitely
the kind of work that I do too.
And I think that that's something that we definitely help each other with now.
We do,
when we're having that feeling that, you know, nothing is ever enough.
It's just sometimes having that person to turn to and say, this just feels overwhelming, and I don't know how I'm gonna do it. You know, I was sending all those text messages during the editing process for this book, and you know,
it
and
was
you
a
were just
cheerleading marathon.
It was,
But it was also, I think it's also important. Like, I always really make the effort to remind Lauren that this, you know, this is what she's always wanted, and you know, she's brilliant, and she always has been. She won't say that. But if you've never read Lauren's work, you must get out there and pick up both her books. But she writes just beautifully, and she researches as well, if not better, than a lot of academics that I've seen. So I think reminding the people that you see that, you know, in them, and that, you know, just keep going, you know, don't listen to that voice that tells you that you can't, because I know that you can, and that's just super important to have. And I know she does that for me as well. So
It's nice to have that support network, isn't it? It's actually, it is a lifeline, because if you were, I just don't even know how you'd do it all by yourself. Like, it's such a solitary kind of job, writing. And, you know, you don't see people for days on end, and especially in the editing process, which just feels like going into a cave, as you remember, you know, we were talking about your PhD, and I was telling you about how usually the turnaround is about like 6 weeks for a book, which just seems insurmountable at the start of that editing process. But so, yeah, you're like the connection to the outside world, even though it feels like you're just in your own head. 6 weeks.
I think community is just super important, even for those of us that are introverted, those of us that, you know, really are, we live the life of the mind, you know, we do kind of spend a lot of time in there.
That's a good way
and
of putting it.
We still need the communities and the connections, but I think the people in those communities, it's really important that they understand, you know, that not just your work, but also, like we were saying, the way that your mind works and the way that you, you know, you can be, we have a tendency to be kind of sensitive and, like we were saying, quite anxious and, you know, but they're all gifts that are, you know, they have both sides to them, don't they? You know, they enable us to do what we do, because we can kind of pick up those subtleties and nuances and then articulate them. But yeah, you do need, I think, that compassion from people that have done that. So, on that note, like talking about creativity, we were going to talk about how to reignite that after, you know, life-changing events. And Lauren has two little human life-changing events that walk around her house every day. Beautiful little human life-changing events.
They're way too, you know, in my face at the moment. I really need a break from them. But we're all in the same boat, I guess, people who have kids and they're just around all the time and there's no escape from them. But, yeah, it's, I mean, I don't regret having kids. I think they've actually added a huge kind of, they really helped me open up and understand, you know, my emotions and what's at stake as well.
Yeah, definitely. And seeing things through their eyes as well, I'm sure. You know, they have that originality, that way of capturing the world that you think, wow.
They do. They do. And they live in the present. They're so good at that, which, you know, sometimes I think can forget to do when we're really busy. And so that has been one of the great things about being home with them all the time, I suppose. Mm. They constantly want to go to the park. We only go once a day.
You have to get that fresh air and sunshine.
Yeah, I really look forward to it now, taking them out. Yeah, and there's just no other option, you know. There's no excuses. And so that's been one, I guess, one silver lining.
Have your children or anything else you've experienced actually stopped your writing, like completely stopped it? Because I think there's so much pressure in our society now to be productive all the time. Like we were saying, through COVID-19, you know, we're supposed to be super productive because we're all at home just sitting at our computers. That's not what's happening. But, you know, has there been, you know, some, like, a time where it's literally just completely stopped? I mean, it never does, I think, because you're always thinking, but...
I mean, I've never stopped writing or doing sort of creative jobs. I think probably one of the only times that I really stopped was when I had a miscarriage, a stillbirth, and that for me was so, you know, like so in the moment.
Profound,
It was so profound. And but even as I was going through the pain of it, I was thinking, like, I will remember this and I will write about it. Even if I don't write about it explicitly, I will use it in my work. And so that was probably one of the only times where I've just had to say, no, I just can't, because physically, you know, you've got to recover.
Yeah, I just need to rest. I think we spoke through some of the work you were doing on Gulliver's Wife, that was sort of something that you were faced with during that process, right? Do you want to just quickly talk about Gulliver's Wife and what the... She's just released it, so she probably should give it a spruik.
Yeah, I know, but I just wanted to really talk to you. So it's a story about Mary Burton, who is Lemuel Gulliver's wife, long-suffering spouse. It's set in the 18th century, so it's set in 1702 between his first journey, when he comes home from his first journey to the little island of Lilliput, where the small people live, and the second sort of journey, so when he's gone back out to sea. And Mary is midwife. There's only about sort of six lines about her in Gulliver's Travels, which was written in 1726. And so I thought when I was reading it, rereading it.
The Invisible Woman.
Yeah, The Invisible Woman. Mm. And I wanted to know what about her life and what life would have been like for women like Mary left behind to care for their kids and just expected to be there when the husbands came back.
Yeah.
And that I wanted to know what her adventures might have been like because,
And thinking about what we were talking about, just going back to earlier in the conversation when I said that I found Plath in the library, we should probably give a huge shout out to libraries because that kind of started your writing career, didn't it, to some degree, finding the inspiration for The Lace Weaver, which was Lauren's first novel.
Yeah, so I was working in my local library and I was putting the books away and I found a book on knitted Estonian lace and didn't know anything about Estonia. And so I thought, oh, you know, that would just make an amazing kind of story. I wanted to research more about it. And then I was also, you know, that's where I was rereading Gulliver's Travels. I tried to read all the books in the 1001 Books to Read Before You Die section, which didn't work out too well. I didn't get through that many of them. But I got through Gulliver's Travels, and so that was a good thing too, yeah. But what about you? What are your favourite libraries? Like what's helped you?
You really want to go down that rabbit hole?
Well, you must have seen some amazing libraries. And I also want you to tell me about the archives because you went over to Harvard last year.
Yes. I was a research fellow at Harvard last year. That's right. So,
And you wanted and you had to go into into the archives there to look.
So my current project is a history of the New England Poetry Club, which is a literary society that was started in 1915 by some really important figures, including Robert Frost and Amy Lowell, Conrad Aiken, if anybody knows, they're American poets. I kind of fell upon my project while I was doing my PhD. Sounds like I just kind of went, oh, there it is, I'll just do that. But I was lucky enough to discover some archival material during my my PhD journey, and I was working on a completely different project, obviously. That led to me working on donating materials to the Rare Book Library at Harvard, which is Houghton. Sadly closed at the moment. Harvard's closed. Everything's closed. There are some incredible libraries, obviously, at those Ivy League colleges. And Houghton is one of my favourite places to work. The Schlesinger at Harvard is also fantastic. So, they are, as you know, Lauren's got her experience in her own archives, they're magical places where you go in and you put your white gloves on and you deal with these records or books I've worked with materials from the whole spectrum of materials that you can find. I've even touched a Sylvia Plath's hair. Can you believe it or not?
Wow.
It was my like creepy cultish moment.
It's a little bit fetishistic, isn't it?
It is. It's funny though.
People are
big on hair. A lot of Plath's materials are in the they're obviously at the college that she went to. I say obviously because, you know, if you know anything, you know she went to Smith College, which is it's not that well known. I just say it because it's in my head and I've known for so long. She went to an all-girls college called Smith, which is in a town called Northampton in Massachusetts in the US. And there is an incredible collection of her materials there in their Rare Book collection and in their library. And the Lilly Library in Indiana is also fantastic for Plath materials. And that was where I saw the lock of her hair. Her mother actually cut, I don't know how many, it was like a good 5 to 8 inches, I'd say. I'd say inches in my American mind. Like a lock, you know, when you see like a full lock of hair. And it was, it was several inches thick as well. And so she cut like quite a lot off her hair and then tied a ribbon around it. And it was kind of creepy because when the librarians brought it out, there it was, this beautiful, and it was quite old, and it was almost red, reddy brown.
Really?
And that was at the Sylvia Plath symposium that I went to.
Oh, cool.
many, many years ago now. But yeah, that was one of my freaky cultish moments.
Why do you think people, I mean, I know we've spoken about this earlier, but why do you think people love Plath? Like, what is it about Plath when she...
I think it's that she has this way in her writing of, this is going to sound quite graphic, but, you know, ripping her chest open and showing you what's inside. She is not, but she does it so well. Like, she's very, I believe that she was an incredibly intelligent person. So, you know, incredibly articulate and, you know, just fluent in, you know, historical frameworks and ways of speaking. She was very, very well read. And so it all comes in to what she spits back out, if that makes any sense. So it's beautiful. It's a beautiful experience, you know, when you read something that is just a pleasure to read, but it's also quite, it can be confronting, it can be funny, it can be engaging. It's like, it's like meeting an incredibly vibrant person that you just can't get enough of.
It's so surprising, you know, the way that she phrases things and her observations are just, it's like turning over a shell and you just think, oh, there's...
And then sometimes the poetry is challenging for people because it's poetry and people are scared of that. But, you know, I'd love to love to talk more about that, but that's a whole different podcast episode.
But we should probably talk about success. We should probably talk about success. Did Sylvia have success in her lifetime? Did she experience success?
She had some success. She had nowhere near the success of her husband, which I think was one of the biggest challenges that she faced, and there's been a lot of backlash about that since, you know, her death. And you know, he became sort of the person that managed her literary estate, and in the first publication of Ariel, he you know, maneuvered that himself in the way that he believed, I think, it was to, you know, he wanted to do it or she wanted to do it, but there was that element of someone else controlling, you know, her output. So, which has been rectified by a an edition of Ariel called the Restored Edition. So if anybody gets wants to buy a copy of Ariel, I recommend that, because it's, I'm just showing Lauren on the video screen right now. It's actually a facsimile of Plath's manuscript reinstating her original selection and arrangement.
Right.
So she actually left that on her desk when she passed away. I mean, we should probably identify the elephant in the room, which is that people always talk about Plath as the poet that killed herself. You know, she, the one, I actually wrote trigger a paper warning. Once. Yeah, trigger warning. I wrote a paper once about that, you know, isn't she the one who put her head in the oven, which is something that she's kind of known as.
Terrible thing to be kind of known.
And I hate that. You want to
be known, like, for your work.
Exactly. And I focused a lot in my own research on her earlier writing, because a lot of her later poetry is very dark and does kind of deal with, you know, the breakdown of her marriage and those kind of things. But, I mean, and I don't think we should be afraid of confronting those things, because they're part of life. But but it does overshadow sometimes the other parts of her her creativity. And and I think, I don't know whether people attach themselves to that, to her, because of that dark mythology as well, you know, for it has that gothic kind of element to it. But I mean, personally,
we consider ourselves, it's not even something that you think about, that your work might one day be kind of curated or selected parts of it because of who you are. I mean, so
so Plath Plath died in the early 60s, and really her popularity was part of the second wave feminism resurgence in the 70s. She, you know, along with other poets like Anne Sexton, she became sort of part of that movement to sort of bring up these women that had been dealing with, you know, issues around femininity and oppressed femininity and stuff like that. So there was a massive explosion of criticism around Plath particularly and other poets, and then the publications of a whole bunch of things came out after that. So, but it's, I mean, it's ongoing, and I would like to hope that those kind of that cultishness and that sort of there was a lot of anger, I think, a lot of anger around. I know there's one story about Ted Hughes was her husband, who was also a poet, You know, makes it interesting too, because you've got the two poets in their kind of parallel lives. But he came out to Australia for a visit, and there was a massive protest. You know, you killed Sylvia and all this kind of horrible stuff in Australia. So And there's, you know, the stories of her gravestone has Sylvia Plath Hughes, but people have time and time again scratched off the Hughes part. It's really, really horrible stuff. But
well, I'm really glad that you're researching her, you know, and that she's still a part of your interest and your, you know, she's always going to be there for you. And
yeah, I'd like to change that narrative though and focus more on the person that she was, you know, rather than all but of that sort of negative stuff. Yeah, I try.
Yeah. Yeah. I try. So tell me how you celebrate your success. How did you celebrate finishing off your PhD? Like,
I don't know. It's really important. Yeah, I'm probably going to answer this badly, because maybe tell me how you celebrate all of your wins, because you've had some huge ones. No. But when you do a PhD, it's really interesting because you submit the it's a book basically, so it can be like 80,000 to 100,000 words, and you submit it to your examiners, and then you generally get it back for corrections, which is just like edits in most cases, unless you have a lot of changes to make. Then you submit it again, you know, and then it takes sort of time, and there's all the administrative stuff in the uni. And by the time you actually get it approved and then, you know, graduate, I don't know, like 18 months has probably passed, if not more. It's not, I mean, there's that moment when you press send and you send your manuscript and that's it. Like, that's pretty woo, you know, but you're usually so exhausted by that point that you're just happy to have it over. So I don't know if I did anything, to be honest.
I've got to say, I'm kind of the same about about success.
Anticlimax.
It's always a bit of an anticlimax. Like, I do celebrate it, but in my own way and with people like you. Like, you know, we'll just send a text message and go, oh, you know, I finished. It feels so, you're just so drained and exhausted by the end of one of those big projects, aren't you? That it does take a while to kind of process the fact that you're not going to be working on it. And I've heard people say that it's almost like a little bit of grief, in a sense, that but then I guess for me, between the time of finishing the book and publication, you can kind of celebrate it more because it feels like you've had some time away from it, and it's not so much a part of you, and then you're putting it out there anyway for it to be critiqued and criticized, and which you know, you would be familiar with as well, that people are going to have opinions about it, and it's kind of good to be distanced from that. And so that then you don't take it on personally, because it's not personal, it's just this work.
Yeah, and it's ongoing. I think that's like when you make a career out of this stuff, it's not like you just kind of bake a cake and present it and then that's it. Exactly. There's no, you know, it's like you're always baking. Next day you get up and there's still flour in your kitchen. So, you know,
I love baking.
You love baking. I thought you'd like that metaphor.
I like that one.
Yep. Be sure to pick up Lauren's other book.
Stop it. No. So we've talked a little bit about, we've talked about creativity. We've talked about Sylvia Plath and her success. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should just talk quickly about rejection, because I think we've been a good couple of minutes to go.
Yeah.
And how we both deal with rejection, and also how Plath deal with rejection. So maybe you can start with her.
How Plath dealt with rejection? She's an incredible inspiration if you want to look at somebody that just worked their butt off, you know, and just submitted. And she did the same both for and with Ted Hughes, you know. She was really responsible, I think, for a lot of his early success, submitting to prizes and, you know, different things. He had a lot of success with his first poetry book. You know, they, as a married couple, they sort of both benefited from that success. But I just think it's part of the daily baking of the cake. You just keep it going, you know. And it's the same. You get one accepted, then you might get edits, you might get changes, you get, you know, there's always, it's just ongoing. And maybe, you know, we probably both should be better at celebrating those successes, because it might make our journey better, because it does. I'm just kind of,
it feels a bit inauthentic sometimes, that's all, because the process of actually writing it feels separate to, you know, promoting it or talking about it. You have to find that middle ground of you know, celebrating and being proud of what you've achieved, but
I think we're both overselling. I think we're both reasonably modest as well, which, you know, I think I know you are. I'm always telling Lauren to sell herself more. You know, you're amazing, you know, personal cheerleader. But I think that maybe that's part of it as well. We kind of just get on with doing what we do. And
because that's the work, you know, the work is the work. It's not it's not that myth of the creative that we were talking about. Sometimes things are just out of your control, you know, and look at what's happening now, and you just think, you know, this wasn't how I planned for my book to come out and not be available in the bookshops, or it's in the bookshops, but nobody can actually get to the bookshops. But that's just completely out of my hands.
That's
all I can do is work on the next book and try and get that done. And I think move forward that way.
If you submit something, if you send something off, if you've created something, that's never a failure.
I agree.
You know, it might be rejected your entire life, but that doesn't matter, because you created it, and you need to have sort of faith in that it stands alone, because the creation of something is always, you know, a massive win as far as I'm concerned, just to kind of, you know, get over that personal barrier that we all have, as you
know.
The doubt.
So just to finish off, did Sylvia doubt herself, or was
totally totes. And I think that's where the I you know, really connected with her, with her journals, you know, and just the kind of rumination and the thinking and the, you know, am I ever going to be, she was very ambitious, like much more ambitious than most, you know, she wanted
female ambition.
She wanted to be the poet of America, but I liked her as well, because she wanted to be, she was very astute about building her own brand and actually promoting herself and actually wanting to be part of mainstream culture. So she didn't want to be some elitist sort of poetic genius that nobody ever read. That wasn't her.
That's really interesting.
She entered like competitions for TV jingles and things like that. So
no way.
She was about making money to support herself and her family. And she was also she wasn't a snob about what she did, and she wanted to be known. She wanted to be out there. So
nobody should be ashamed about having to make money.
For a poet too, like poetry has got this long history of kind of elitism, and sometimes even now it kind of, you know, goes into that area of, you know, it's not. But I think it's just writing, and it's just storytelling, and it's just different forms of expression, and it is in everything. It is in advertising. It is in, you know, those different areas of life. And she was just on it. She was just kind of like, I'm gonna get my words and writing and ideas out however I can. And she just kept going. And I don't know if that was why she burnt out a bit in the end, but you know, she shone very brightly. So and I think she's a good role model. A lot of people think she's not because of the way that her life ended, but I don't agree with that at all. I think she's a fantastic role model for writers, so check her out, and check out Lauren Chatersworth as well.
We should wrap it up now.
We should, I'll stop spreaking you promoting you now.
please stop. I'm mortified now. It was really good to chat, and we should be in contact soon.
I will read
some more plaid, and then I'll have lots of questions for you.
Okay, I look forward
to it. Okay, all right, see you soon.
Bye.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.